ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From the frontier wars of country to the battlegrounds of Gallipoli, Berlin, and Saigon, Blackfellas have always kept our warrior spirit strong. But how can we best honour the sacrifice and service? Yama Malia, and welcome to Away, the home of Indigenous arts and culture on ABC Radio National. I'm Rudy Bremer. Today, you'll pay tribute to our Black Diggers, as Pastor Ray Minikin reflects on 2 decades of the Coloured Diggers Project and explains why he's still driven to achieve proper respect, honour and dignity for all Black veterans. It's a story that'll introduce you to some of the servicemen and women throughout history who've dedicated their lives to achieving equality. Then, playwright Wesley Enoch is bringing the Sapphires back to Brisbane stages. You'll hear how Wesley feels about returning to the director's seat after all this time. Plus, for Word Up, Daisy Allen is sharing a little more Palawakani, this time honouring an iconic Tasmanian animal. And just a warning, this episode of Away contains the names and voices of people who have died. Stay with me and listen with care.
Stuart, what's your reaction when you hear comments such as Aboriginals didn't fight to defend Australia?
Well, that's one of the things that really upset me when so many of our people did fight in all the wars that Australia's been involved in and made the supreme sacrifice. Young people, you know, 17 or 18, 19, and they'd never been given any credit or proper recognition. And we're only asking for respect on that question.
That's Stuart Murray in 1985. He's talking to an ABC reporter about Black Diggers being excluded from marching together under their own flag. See, Stuart was a Barapurapa Yorta Yorta Wiradjuri Wamba Wamba Dadaroa man, and a veteran of the Second World War. And even before that interview, Stuart had been advocating for the equal recognition and compensation of First Nations veterans for years. It's a fight that continues to this day. And one of the people who've taken on the challenge is Pastor Ray Minikin. He's seen the discrimination Black Diggers face, how many were denied land under soldier settlement schemes and paid less than non-Indigenous veterans. 20 years ago, the Cubby Cubby and Garangarang man, along with a couple of his mates, Chris Carbon and Warren Morgan, started a project that'd bring national focus to the thousands of Black Diggers whose service was never recognised. They called it the Coloured Diggers Project. It was organised by mob for mob to remember the Black veterans who fought for their country, only to return to the same racism and discrimination that was there when they left. Ray joined me in the Away studio to explain where the idea of the Black Diggers Project came from.
The thing is that I was just saying to a friend of mine, his name was Chris Carbon, he's passed on now, that and he was a white fella, that my grandfather fought in World War One as a light horseman, the 11th Light Horse, the Black Watch, a very, very, very big story which we need to tell sometime. And also I had 2 brothers in Vietnam, and I know when my eldest brother came back, he was in the regulars, the other brother was part of the call-up. And so when my eldest brother came back, he was one of the first over there with the Yanks, came back, and they had a march through the streets for the Vietnam vets. Or the soldiers at that time, and you'll recall that was the time when we were protesting against the Vietnam War here in Australia. And so as he was marching down the street, some woman came over and poured a bucket of white paint over him. welcome home, brother. And so I don't know what was going on in his mind, but the very first thing he did is went back and signed up for another tour of Vietnam. And he did four tours. And it seemed like, you know, in my interpretation of what of that particular action of my brother, he was trying to say, well, I mean, I'd rather face bullets than the wrath and the anger of my own country if they're not going to accept me as a soldier defending their peace. So he went back and done another four tours.
You're sitting down with your mate and you're reflecting on your family history of service and the way that these men were treated when they returned. How did that lead to the Coloured Diggers March?
Well, what we decided, we would have our own first Anzac Day ceremony for our own Aboriginal diggers so that we could remember them, you know, lest we forget. And so we had a little ceremony in a little building there we used to call Crossroads in Redfern and George Street, and we invited our community to say, come on, let's acknowledge, honour and respect our own diggers, our own warriors. And what it was a very good service, very meaningful for all of us. After that, we had all the local Aboriginal churches come together to do that, to make that ceremony really, really something very special. And after that, seeing that, we decided we'd do a march the next year in the streets of Redfern there just to acknowledge our diggers. And so we went home, organised the whole thing from Redfern there in Redfern, and we went out and invited, you know, dignitaries and governors and whoever else, parliamentarians. And the thing that sparked it really, which was something that I didn't even expect, because in my mind I'm saying, okay, yeah, we can march down to the church there and have a ceremony again, a service, proper service, to recognise our Aboriginal diggers. And I'd, you know, we would probably get around 50 black fellas around there, you know, marching down the streets there saying, yeah, what do we want? And we wrote to the Minister for Defence at that time, Brendan Nelson, and we wrote to him as well as the national chair or president of the RSL. It was just normal courtesy to do that anyways, because these fellows fought for this country. And their response to our little march, and we had organised it, we thought about it very, very clearly, that we would not interfere with the main march. We weren't that radical. We just said that the Anzac Day is for everybody. And so we would wait until they finished their march and they all went away to the pub and played two up. We would then honour our own. And so we started around about 2 o'clock, and we marched for who was going to march at that time. Anyways, when we wrote to these two characters, they said in the national press or media, I'm not quite sure where, but they said that we will not recognise that march in Redfern.
Wow.
So they gave us the best marketing of our march that we could ever, ever ask for, and we didn't have to pay for it. So you can imagine the controversy that particular moment had created, and the problem it created for the government, but also the opportunity it created for us as Indigenous peoples here in this country to honour our own Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander soldiers. And when we started the march, there was the press came from all around the world. They wanted to know why didn't Australia recognise the Indigenous soldier. And when we started marching, I expected 50. We had about 800. We led the march down the streets to the church, to St. Saviour's in Redfern, to have this first ceremony there. And, you know, we wrote the liturgy for it, we wrote the order of service, all that kind of stuff. We did it to honour our soldiers. And we focused on, is it four or five things at that particular time? When we wanted to start this march, how would you honour your ancestors in a way in which would be which would give them that kind of prestige that we wanted to see? So we wanted to honour them, respect their services, and we wanted to make sure that their memory is always remembered. And our people came out in full force to make sure that their ancestors, their fathers, their grandparents, their uncles, their aunties were remembered and recognised at that first march. And there were a number of things that we decided that we wanted to do. One was to do the march and the commemoration ceremony ourselves. Two, we wanted a monument, but you can't call it a monument because it's too political and too controversial. Mm. And, you know, the Waifella's brains can't come around the Aboriginal mindset and these things. How do you honour your people? But we call it a sculpture. We decided that we wanted a sculpture. And we went around and I found an artist who would do this for us. He lived up in Rydal, up here in the Blue Mountains. And because I wanted, if we're going to have a sculpture, the monument, it would be in bronze. Because we knew that it would last a long, long, long time. And so this is the only guy that we knew who worked with bronze in New South Wales. His name is Anthony Simmons. And so I went up and had a talk to him about it, you know, saying what I wanted. And he helped us design, I think, one of the most profound sculptures to honour the Aboriginal digger. Because I said, I don't want to see an Aboriginal guy in bronze standing there with a 303 rifle in the uniform with the hat on saying this is our Aboriginal soldier. So what we came up with was these six dancing figures, male and female, in this inner circle. And the whole concept behind it was this is who we are. Here we are dancing together. And we wanted to put this monument, this sculpture, and I did all the lobbying for it, down in front of the MCA because that's where the ships took off to the wars. And what we were trying to say is that we put the sculpture there, the people will see this and saying, okay, we've been a part of this dance and now we're going overseas to fight so that they can continue this dance. And that when they come back from overseas and land back there in Circular Quay again, the dance, the sculpture would say, come, join the dance again. And we thought that would be the way in which you honour the true warriors of our people through that particular sculpture. We didn't get that one, but the one we got now is really important too, and that's the one that's in Hyde Park now, the bullets.
Tony Albert?
Tony Albert, yeah. Yes, yeah. The good thing is, you know, that our sculpture sparked all of those conversations and forced, the institutions and the powers that be to actually make a decision or make a choice about the things that they hadn't done before. We also wanted to have our own honour roll so that our diggers could be remembered, but with a little bit of a difference. So for my brothers, it would have been, you know, Still and James Minicon, Cubby Cubby, and Gurang Gurang, so that their tribes identified as well, or their tribal backgrounds. And I thought that would be appropriate for us. And, you know, we weren't worried too much about what the Gabbas thought. This is our responsibility towards our own ancestors to make sure that they're remembered, not just now, but for future generations.
See, the inspiration for this project all started with the poem The Coloured Digger, written by a non-Indigenous veteran named Bert Berros. Have a listen to it.
He came and joined the colours when the war god's anvil rang. He took up modern weapons to replace his boomerang. He waited for no call-up. He didn't need a push. He came in from the stations and the townships of the bush. He helped when help was wanting, just because he wasn't deaf. He is right among the columns of the fighting AIF. He is always there when wanted, with his Owen gun or Bren. He's in the forward area, the place where men are men. He proved he's still a warrior, in action, not afraid. He faced the blasting red-hot fire from mortar and grenade. He didn't mind when food was low, or we were getting thin. He didn't growl or worry then, he'd cheer us with his grin. He'd heard us talk democracy, they preach it to his face, yet knows that in our federal house, there's no one of his race. He feels we push his kinsmen out where cities do not reach, and Parliament has yet to hear the Aborigines' maiden speech. One day he'll leave the army, then join the League he shall. He hopes we'll give a better deal to the Aboriginal.
For Ray, this poem captured what his project was all about, honouring our ancestors and drawing upon the warrior spirit. But he also says the early days of finding information about black diggers were tough.
I know when we first started out, we went down to the war memorial there to get some information and stuff of that nature. The war memorial had sweet nothing. And the only researchers at that time were two white people. One was Philippa Scarlett is her name.
Yeah.
And she's the one who really had the most information or the research on Aboriginal soldiers in the country, or possibly even on the planet. And there was another guy called David, I think his name last name is Huddleston, I'm not quite sure. But he did have an exhibition that was going around the country called Too Dark for the Light Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to that exhibition and I was a little bit perturbed by it because as I went around and seen all the photographs and everything, all the research that he had done, it was a brilliant, brilliant exhibition. Right at the end was this one, the photograph of a Aboriginal soldier in the jungles of Vietnam. And I took a look and I said, hey, that's my brother. He was the unknown soldier. I said, well, hang on a second.
That fella's known.
Yeah, I rang my brother and said, hey, they got your photograph here, you're an unknown. And he says, oh, no, they rang me. And he said he gave them permission to call him the unknown soldier. I don't think he minded. He was that kind of character. He didn't want to be known.
So here we are in 2026. And you've talked about some of those, the goals and the aims that you had in the beginning.
Hmm.
What are the current goals?
Well, the current goals haven't changed.
Hmm.
I don't think we've achieved our main objective yet. And that is proper respect for Indigenous soldiers, proper honour, proper dignity for their contribution. And so we have to do everything that we can to make sure that that's out. And I mean, there's the good thing is now that there's books there that people can read. There's a lot of research that has been going on like, you know, that was sparked by Philippa Scarlett. And people are now starting to look at that. We did have one old uncle from Tumula, but when he came in March with us, the very first thing that he wanted to do, and he was a veteran, he wanted to go back to his community and make sure that there was a roll of honour of all the Aboriginal people that fought or came from that particular community. And I mean, that's what I want to see, that every community has that, but also to transfer those names back onto the RSL's roll of honour, but at the end of it, just put that tribal identity there, you know, Gamilaroi or you know, whatever, Wiradjuri. That to me would be the greatest honour. And also, you know, what we've uncovered too, I remember finding out that there were some soldiers from Bourke, the Knights. They got a DCM, you know, Distinguished Cross Medal for their exploits. I mean, how many more of those? And another aspect of it too that was uncovered or that came through too, and another part of the research was the Aboriginal soldiers who fought in the Boer War. We've uncovered around about 10 of those already, and we had one that was buried out here in the Botany Cemetery in an unmarked grave. So, you know, the researcher who did that, Peter, he trailed all of that, tracked it all back to that one little spot. And I got the call and says, Ray, we need to make sure we honour him by putting a proper gravestone over him. We did that. That was a tough task, but we did it to make sure that he got honoured. But I also realised, and I mean, I think we all realise as Aboriginal people, that there are so many graves, unmarked graves, of Aboriginal soldiers who fought overseas and have not been honoured.
People feel a lot more conflicted about honouring service of more contemporary wars. And I wonder, do you feel that pressure or that discomfort in the Coloured Diggers March?
Oh, yeah.
As we move further away from these, like, historic...
Yeah. And these present-day conflicts, it just goes to show a couple of things. One, these wars weren't created and never will be created by Indigenous peoples. That's the first thing. They're not our wars. And the bigger thing is that our people actually joined in and went and fought. And I can't get to the mystery behind all of that. I can only surmise that that's the spirit of the warrior in them, to say, okay, if you want to go over there and fight, I'll join you and I'll help you. You know, my grandfather's in the Light Horse in Palestine. You know, you wonder. They go over there and fight, and then they come back and they're not recognised. I think it does come back to how we recognise and how we honour soldiers in this country. We're not very good at it. I often used to say in the early days that if you want to look at a country that has done the recognition of their own soldiers, Indigenous soldiers, then go to New Zealand. Because you can walk into libraries and you can walk into museums and they'll have the Maori soldier there as a part of their recognition of that particular individual and what he has done. I mean, they can't escape it over there. Not only do they honour their own soldiers who fought in overseas conflicts, but they also honour the frontier wars. And so we haven't even got to that stage. Mm. And so you can see how far we've got to go. And, you know, I hope and pray that young people are listening and saying, well, I'll take up the charge, right? What do I need to do? Well, then just get out there, get your mob together and start marching in the streets. We still have the warrior spirit within us. We can't let that die. We've got to keep on fighting.
That was Pastor Ray Minikin, a black veteran who dedicated much of his life to securing equal recognition and remembrance of black diggers. He walked in the Coloured Diggers March to honour the legacy of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander veterans who fought for these lands. I'm Rudy Bremer, and you're listening to Away on ABC Radio National. You might be interested to know that black diggers weren't the only ones denied respect and remembrance for their service to this country. Four Yorta Yorta women scouted to perform popular soul tunes for soldiers fighting in the Vietnam War were also denied recognition. In 2004, the story of the Sapphires was turned into a critically acclaimed musical, written by Tony Briggs and directed by Quandamooka man Wesley Enoch. Fast forward a few years, and the stage musical was turned into a film starring Deb Mailman, Shari Sebbins, Miranda Tapsell, and Jessica Malboy. Meanwhile, on stage, The Sapphires is a show that's continued to tour and continued to showcase new talent. And now, a sparkling new cast of Sapphires are getting ready to take to the stage at Brisbane's Billy Brown Theatre, with Wesley returning as the play's director. We caught up a few weeks back to reminisce and reflect on returning to direct The Sapphires more than 20 years after that original run.
When I think back when I was in my early 30s, I was doing this show, and now I'm in my later 50s. And that whole idea of going, how much has the world changed, and how much of it hasn't changed? You know, we get constant reminders that these kind of theatre pieces are classics in many ways. They tell a story of a particular moment in time, but we can actually mark ourselves by how we've grown, how society has grown, by looking back at these classic pieces of theatre.
I was thinking about it, and that Sydney run at Belvoir Street Theatre, it was the first musical that I had ever seen.
Wow.
So I have a really vivid memory of going along to a weekend matinee with my mum and some of her friends.
Fabulous.
and being completely swept up in the music, the humour, the gorgeous performances by Ursula Leovich, by Deb Mailman. When you think back to that original run, what are the memories that stand out to you?
You've got to remember too that we didn't know it was going to be a success.
Mm.
You know, that the idea when you're in the rehearsal room and you're working with these incredible performers, and you name them there, Deborah Mailman, Ursula Leovich, Rachel Mazza, Lisa Flanagan, the incredible kind of energy that came from these women was amazing. And we didn't know that it was going to be anything more than a really hard slog. You know, like, these were women who were singing and dancing and acting and costume fittings and wig fittings and eyelashes and everything for weeks on end. And there was such hard work. And those people were just amazing, those women. And we didn't know it was going to hit a moment. And I remember the first preview back in 2004 in Melbourne, the first preview where here we are, tired beyond belief, just pushing this big show into reality, a brand new work, and just the reaction of the audience. And at the end, almost an ecstatic kind of leaping to their feet and just kind of just applauding. And you've got to remember, this period of time was coming to the end of the John Howard prime ministership. You know, there'd been a lot of things. The ATSIC was being kind of abolished, and there was the intervention into Northern Territory. There was the cutting of funding to Indigenous peoples. There was the prime minister not apologising. And here came a story of Aboriginal resilience, of power, and Tony Briggs What an insight he did to make this musical happen. And it was a celebration of being black in this country, and the audience just went ape for it. You know, they just went, they just got up and just realised that we could actually celebrate Aboriginal Australia, not just feel bad for it. And it was amazing, absolutely amazing experience. And I think that every production I've seen of The Sapphire since has had that same kind of DNA, that it's not just talking about our deficits, the things that, you know, were hard done by, where we're over-incarcerated and under-housed and all the other things that we know, the closing the gap kind of targets are there for a reason, and they're important reasons. But here's a moment to celebrate our blackness, and that was extraordinary in that moment in time.
What do you think it is about The Sapphires that keeps people coming back to it as a show?
I think audiences can get nostalgic as well. I mean, at the time, I think those people who were in their 60s and maybe even their 50s remembered the 1960s and 70s in a very nostalgic way. And so they kind of went, oh, yeah, great, all the music. And now, 20 years later, it's almost incredibly retro to kind of go back and see the music. There's something too about the story being a powerful, empowering story of Indigenous women kind of going, yep, we can make a go of it. We can go over and see the world. And the play is set, well, in my mind, in 1968, and it's the year after the referendum, and these women go, great, I can go anywhere I want. I can get a passport and go anywhere I want and see the world. There was a real sense of ambition that was forming after the 67 referendum. And perhaps one of the reasons to do it now is we're a bit despondent after the 23 referendum. There's a real heaviness of heart. And when we see the kind of powers of not just conservatism, but the powers of oppression kind of gaining more force, it's really powerful to say, no, we're going to sing you down. You know, we're going to celebrate through this particular play again, another way of seeing us, not as the poor black fellas who need a hand up or whatever, but actually really empowered, powerful people who can make a difference in the world. So I think audiences love to see themselves as supporters of power rather than, you know, the kind of, here's a charitable act. I think audiences love to say, no, we are equals here. And there's a real power in that for them as well.
So, Wesley, you've got an all-new cast for your latest production. Can you talk me through your lead women?
Oh, these great women. You know, one of the joys of getting older is that your job is not just to look after your own career, but to help other careers develop. And these four women, it's real investment in their abilities and their and promoting them and giving them a platform to grow. I mean, Tague Twist, extraordinary performer, really amazing, and is belting out those songs like you wouldn't believe. I mean, all the cast are definitely. I mean, people might know Taya McCartney, who is... She's been around a bit. She just did some touring with Il Bidgeri, actually, doing a Big Name No Blanket. Mm. And, you know, and she did the Sunshine Club last year with us. And so getting her on board to play this particular role is fantastic. Ruby, who is a graduate from WAPA, she originally comes from Queensland, and she's mostly a straight actor. And when she told me the story, she said after she did this initial audition thing, she apparently wrote me an email saying, oh, Wesley, I don't think I can do this show. I don't feel confident enough to sing. And I didn't get that email. And we were chatting and Ruby said, did you ever get this email? And I went, no. And I found it eventually in my junk or something. And she said, I'm glad you didn't, because I can do this. And there was a real sense of confidence that she wanted to be stretched. She's an actor and she's going, oh, I don't know how to sing so much. And you go, Deborah Malman didn't know how to sing and she found a way through it. And this incredible sense of confidence that can be built in people as well. And of course, Aurora. Aurora is a beautiful singer and she has a little 2-year-old boy. And just this sense of saying, I'm doing this as much for my family and for my little boy to see me achieving as an artist. She had this conversation about she's a great mother, she's a great partner, she's there, but she wants to stretch herself as a performer and she's doing some great work on stage. These four women are tapping into the spirit of the original Sapphires, who, if people don't know the story, where have you been? Why have you been under a rock all this time? Four Yorta women who go from Melbourne and go to Vietnam to entertain the troops during the war. And these four women in contemporary Brisbane are tapping into that same spirit, saying, actually, we can do things. We can make things happen. We can be ambitious and we can open up the world for the people who come after us. I don't think what we do is easy, even though it's enjoyable for an audience. It's real hard work. But there's something about watching young people, now I'm going to sound like an old man, watching young people enter into their ambition and step into their capacity and open up, and you just go, you're deadly. And I just want to be there to support them. I just want to do a shout out to Nathaniel Andrew, who's the musical director on the show, who's a cousin of Tony Briggs and is a fantastic musical director. And Yolandi Brown, who's the choreographer. And what I've done differently with this production to the ones I've done before is there's a lot more black fellas around in the creative roles. Now, 25 years ago, 20-something years ago, that was a harder thing to do. Now, you can actually find a lot of these really vibrant, interesting, creative, indigenous musical directors, choreographers, video designers. You can find all these people that weren't around and you go, ah, there's a real sense of change happening. And our job now is to maintain that and make sure they have careers so we don't just, you know, leave behind. And can I just do a little shout out to Rhoda Roberts? Because in many ways, the work that Rhoda Roberts achieved in terms of making space for the next generation, I am the beneficiary of. If it wasn't for Rhoda Roberts, you wouldn't have Wesley Enoch. You wouldn't have the opportunities. The companies didn't think in that way. The festivals didn't think in that way about opening up for Indigenous voices. And I can just draw a really clear line from the elders who went before Rhoda, coming through Rhoda, me, and then on to the next generation. And that's what we need to think more and more of, that our creative practice, our storytelling as a nation, is an intergenerational project that is not just about us and what we do, but how we make sure that we engage beyond our lifetime in making sure the stories stay strong.
Wesley, we're marking Anzac Day this week, and I wondered what your reflections are in regards to the way black presence in war is known or understood in our cultural consciousness.
I've done Black Diggers about World War I, Aboriginal soldiers in World War I. I've done the Sunshine Club about World War II. And I've done, you know, the Sapphires, which is about black women going to Vietnam. There's something about black service and the protection of country, the fighting for country that we've always done. And I think especially on Anzac Day, the storytelling around our black presence in all of those theatres of war is such an important thing, that we have been fighting for country ever since, you know, the First Fleet arrived, and we'll do it in lots of different ways. And a shout out to all of those service men and women who served this country and served your community, because it's a very important thing that these shows are trying to lift you up and celebrate you, not pull you down.
I want to go back quite a bit, actually, and I'd love to know, how much did you know about the original real-life Sapphires before you took on the show?
Oh, not much really, because I grew up in Brisbane. I knew Mop and the Dropouts. I knew some of our local bands and local artists. Of course, David Page, you know, was a local boy done well out of Brisbane with his recording career. I didn't know much about the Sapphires. And when Tony Briggs, the writer, told me the story, it was really beautiful, because one of the reasons I think the Sapphires were not a household name in the 70s was because when they came back from Vietnam, they kind of let go of their singing career as a career and dedicated themselves to establishing the Aboriginal Medical Service and the legal service and working in community. And I think that's what you did then. Mm. Like, an arts career has been something that we could only actually imagine after a lot of our fundamentals were in place. Even, you know, we're talking about Black Theatre Redfern and the history of theatre making in this country. It came out of the same movement, the same people who were establishing all these really important community-controlled organisations. But it took a while for the arts to really kind of land. And now we are absolutely the storytellers of the nation. That Indigenous storytellers, Indigenous artists are at such a peak, both nationally and internationally, that we can never, ever be forgotten. And it's because of people like the Sapphires, these women who stepped away from their artistic practice, or maybe always kept their artistic practice going. They never stepped away, but it wasn't their career. They gave their lives to communities in different ways. They gave their hard yakka to going in and really working hard for the community in the 1970s, and we're the beneficiaries of that. So, of course, many people would not have known about the real Sapphires because they did other things as well.
It's lovely to think about the times that I have had an opportunity to interview an original Sapphire has been because of her work in community. And there's something quite special about that.
And perhaps we would not have known the story of Tony Briggs, whose mother and aunts were the Sapphires. We would not know this story if it wasn't for Tony and his ability to be, you know, both an athlete and then an actor and then a writer. And his whole film career, directing and acting in film, really comes from the idea that we are the inheritors of the legacy of these women, these Sapphires.
You are currently the chair of Creative Australia because you are quite obviously still a practicing artist in that you're directing shows. How has that worked for you?
It's interesting. People will compartmentalize an artist and think an artist can't play a governance role or can't be an administrator or can't do things. And I think quite the opposite. In fact, being an artist, being a practicing artist, has made me a better chair of Creative Australia. In many ways, there's been lots of kind of trials and tribulations, which we won't talk about here. But the idea of going as a practicing artist, I know what collaboration looks like. I know what problem solving looks like. I know what building a team and moving forward looks like. And I can do that as the chair of a major funding body in that way. Also, I know how to be cheeky and kind of offer critique and help people grow and understand and discover new ways of operating in the theatre. And that's the same thing in the boardroom. So for me, a policy position is enhanced by your practice as an artist. And as you say, I'm the first practicing artist in several decades to hold the chair. And it's something I really admire the minister for, you know, saying, actually, I'm going to trust artists to do work. I'm going to trust artists that they know the direction and they can be responsible. And I really applaud him for that too.
On the flip side, how has being in that policy maker space influenced the way that you work as an artist?
Oh, I'm totally aware now of the economic impacts of audience numbers. Maybe I always was, but I do love the idea of, reading about audience behaviours. And interesting enough that a lot of the major companies around the country have had real difficulty after COVID. And to look at all that stuff going, hence why they choose a play like The Sapphires, because it's makes you feel good. It's a celebration. It also brings audiences in, and audiences can recognize this play because of the film, because of its history, because of the music. And I go, okay. That's maybe one of the motivating factors to programming a play like this. And I don't, where some people kind of say, oh, that's very popular and that's not good. I go, oh, well, why shouldn't we be talking to audiences and helping audiences engage, and a new generation of audiences too, that the audience isn't static. And being part of this kind of policy position, I realized too that the gains that we may have made as Indigenous Australians, the gains we may have made over the last 25 years or longer, can easily slip back if we don't maintain the work and maintain the artists and build new artists. And so the policy position for me has really enhanced my sense of actually, what's my role, not just in building my career as I enter into my eldership almost, but actually how do I support the next generation to really thrive and not to own them, but to support them to be themselves?
That was Quandamooka playwright and director Wesley Enoch. He's directing the latest production of the beloved musical The Sapphires. Produced by Queensland Theatre Company and Canberra Theatre Centre, The Sapphires returns this Tuesday night with a brand new cast. You can see it at the Billy Brown Theatre in South Brisbane. And for all info on tickets, check out www.queenslandtheatre.com.au. I'm Rudy Bremer, here with you on Away for Radio National. And we've been talking about The Sapphires, so I thought I'd play you Jess Malvoy's cover of I Heard It Through the Grapevine. It featured in the 2012 film adaptation of The Sapphires. I'm Rudy Bremer, and that was Jess Malvoy with I Heard It Through the Grapevine. You're listening to Radio National, and it's time now for Word Up. For the past month, language worker Daisy Allen has been sharing words in her language, Palawakani. Daisy works at the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre, and this week she's sharing the Palawakani name for a cute but devious marsupial.
Pukulba means happy.
Ooh.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
Kinagai.
Birluin.
Walta.
Kalang.
Badjili.
Nalungir.
Bambach.
Dianye.
Injamara.
Guram.
Mijal.
Reipiri.
Ngaraguche nama.
Gani warangung.
Munyip.
Domaninialka. Wakaniniana.
Wardadoia.
Ngundingi dangan.
Wukuk.
Kuwayu.
Delkup.
Diepa.
Murupuk.
Ya Pulingina, Miladina Palawa, Luchawita, Mina, Daisy Allen. Hello everybody and welcome from Luchawita, Tasmania. My name's Daisy Allen and I am sharing today Palawa Kani, which is the language of Tasmanian Aborigines. So the fourth word, I was just going to choose an animal and I just thought off the top of my head I'll go with the Tasmanian devil. So the Palawakani word for Tasmanian devil is Purinina. Purinina. And just recently, I actually spoke with you guys not long ago about two Purinina in a zoo in Aotearoa, New Zealand, that were given Palawakani names. And some Aboriginal children from an Aboriginal childcare in Luchawita and some Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre youth group children all got together and thought, what names can we give these to Purinina in Palawakani? So it was an exciting project for them. So the children looked at their personality traits and one of them was a bit more outgoing and the other one was a bit shy. So they were named to represent the importance of the sea and the ocean between Luchawita and Aotearoa. And when the children watched a few videos of them and got to talk with the zookeepers, they thought that Waiana, shark, would suit the more outgoing Purinina, and that Wiri, starfish, was best for the shyer one. And they had great laughs and they thought it was hilarious with a Purinina, Tasmanian devil, to be named Wiri, starfish. My name's Daisy Allen. I'm speaking Palawakani, the language of Tasmanian Aborigines. Nairi Nina Tu. Thank you for listening and having me share with you Wulika for now.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
That was Daisy Allen sharing some of her language, Palawakani. Daisy has been our language legend all month, and you can find the full series of Word Up, including all our other language legends, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's the show for this week. Thanks for your company. Away was produced on Gadigal Country by Ruby Ritchie and me, Rudy Bremer. Technical production by Antonia Gauci. We'll have more Indigenous arts and culture for you next week on Radio National, or check out a full suite of stories on ABC Listen. You'll find us there along with Word Up and our titter program Speaking Out, hosted by Larissa Berendt. This week, Larissa's looking back at some of her favourite Speaking Out conversations with trailblazers, people like Tanya Hosh and Dr. Terry Jenke. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bremer. Yalu.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.